Hello, Roy here. I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to The Roy Green Show ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
Welcome to The Roy Green Show podcast.
Now, it's not a story. It is a fact of life in Canada. And it is a necessary fact of life. Yesterday was the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation. And that is so incredibly important to each and every person in this country. And today we're joined by, and we've spoken to him many times, is a leading young Canadian Indigenous chief, Chief Cadmus Delorme of Cowessess First Nation in Saskatchewan. And I said earlier, and I'll say it again with the chief on the line, he's an Indigenous chief and a leader. He's also a national leader in this country. Chief, thank you very much for joining us. How are you today?
Good day, Roy. Thanks for welcoming me in.
What did yesterday contribute to the pursuit of truth and reconciliation in Saskatchewan and across this country?
Thank you, Roy. I could hear it in your opening comments that the importance of the relationship between Indigenous people and Canada. Yesterday, personally, on Cowessess First Nation in Treaty 4, Southeast Saskatchewan, we mourned, we celebrated, we reflected on the exact site where the residential school on Cowessess once stood from 1898 to 1996. Survivors told their stories. Some came with tears, some came with humor, some just came with a lesson. And we danced and we sang. And it was a day where we heal. But across this country, September 30th, I really felt the momentum. September 30th, Roy, think of it like strategic planning. It's Canada's day to reflect, are we doing enough in our planning to build a stronger relationship? And we shouldn't just do that on September 30th. September 30th, Roy, should be the day that we assess for the entire year what we're going to be doing one day at a time.
Yes. So you've partly answered the question I was about to ask, but I'm going to ask it anyway, Chief, because I don't think we're going to get caught in redundancy. I think there are issues that need to be spoken about, need to be raised and raised again, because they are so significantly important to the betterment of our complete society. So you're a young and dynamic leader with your finger on the national pulse, and you and I have spoken on air and off. So let me raise this fundamental point. Politicians and governments, media headlines and stories, the classrooms of Canada, all supportive. This is the time for truth and reconciliation. This is of the greatest significance for a positive future for Canada and for the future of Indigenous and non-Indigenous people. So the question I have, Chief Delorme, and I hope I'm not heading into redundancy here, do you have confidence that people generally across Canada, non-Indigenous and Indigenous, are fully engaged and committed to pursuing truth and reconciliation?
Mm-hmm. Roy, I'm a proud Canadian. I'm a proud Saskatchewanian. And most importantly, I'm a proud Indigenous person. I was raised by residential school survivors. And so a lot of my reconciliation internally is to show residential school survivors, including my parents, what reconciliation could look like. From an Indigenous to Indigenous, I can see it. From an Indigenous to Canadian, I really feel the momentum and hope is now. And the unmarked graves that happened across this country, the validation of Kamloops, Maryvale, across this country, for Indigenous people, it was validation of that pain and frustration, tiredness of trying to remain Indigenous in a country that is still somewhat oppressive to Indigenous people. But Roy, the most important part about reconciliation is the response Canadians have given. That shield is down. Many are admitting, I don't know much about the truth between Indigenous people and Canada. We're at a moment, Roy, right now where all of us got to reset our compass just a little bit. We got to think, what put us in this moment? What does our education system do that put us in this moment? The reality is, Roy, that our baby boomers, Generation X and Generation Y, they weren't taught the truth in the education system. Our millennials and Generation Z, they're being told the truth. The most important table for reconciliation right now in 2022 is the kitchen tables across this country. And we must make sure that reconciliation happens. But even to get there, we have to first understand and accept the truth. I do feel hopeful, Roy, that right now the truth is prevailing. The challenge remains is sometimes that ignorance of what we always thought or what we see sometimes in first person, and sometimes how media will persuade something. I'm not discrediting media. They got a very tough job, but are we as Canadians asking the right question? That is where I feel doubt, maybe not doubt, Roy. That's where I feel challenged, but I do feel hopeful, Roy, in the overall of the future.
Chief DeLorme, that kitchen table analogy is so critically important because that's where I believe truth comes out in families. And even if you have friends sit down at a kitchen table, so much of substance can be said. Sometimes people get a little frustrated with one another during these conversations, but ultimately, I think it's to the betterment of the issue that's being discussed. So if, and the residential schools operated, some did, until 1996, if we sat down at the kitchen table with survivors of the residential schools, and we were to have a discussion, a conversation right now, Chief, What would we be hearing from the survivors of the residential schools? Would we be hearing from the survivors that they have a positive sense of what's going on in the country now? Because ultimately, our responsibility is to all of us, but we are very responsible to the people who survived these residential schools. We're responsible to them today. What would we be hearing from them?
Roy, first off, I'm not a residential school survivor. I'm a spokesperson. I'm a chief. My parents were survivors, my grandparents and great-grandparents. My response to your question, Roy, is going to be just from an observation of how I visit with survivors, what they tell me. So please, I'm not trying to say this is the answer for all. Right now across this country, we inherited this moment. Nobody created residential schools. Nobody created the Indian Act. Nobody created 60 Scoop today. But we inherited it. In a country where we share land, where we can be believers, where we can have one of the G7 countries that we live in, we have a responsibility for something we inherited. And for survivors are on different healing journeys across this country. There were 130 residential schools across this country. No school in this country should have a gravesite attached to it. That is the reality of how come this is so important. And to give you a one-minute response now from what a survivor may say, is I'll give you an example of my personal lineage on how this impacts me. My great-great-grandmother never attended a residential school. Her name was Gracie. Had strong Indigenous worldview, very proud, affirmation, physical touch. It was all there, Roy. My great-grandmother attended by force, by Canada law. And she went into horizontal survival mode. She didn't have vertical lineage opportunity. My grandma Evelyn went into horizontal survival mode, didn't have vertical lineage. My mother, horizontal survival mode. They didn't have vertical lineage option that we have today in a country that has good government, is a fairness for all as what this country stands for. Today, Roy, I never attended a residential school. My mother had to raise me, figuring out how to raise a young man, not having vertical lineage from her mom and grandma. And so today, Roy, across this country, our residential school survivors, they are healing. But they're a difference. They have all right to have that pain and frustration and anger and tiredness. As Canadians, we must stand beside them and let them know they're not alone on this journey. We will do better as Canadians because we inherited this. And that is the responsibility, Roy, that Canadians, let's not judge. Let's not say because residential schools were closed in 1996, get over it or change the chapter. No, Roy, we still need a lot of investment today so Indigenous people can get to parity as they always should have.
Chief, you talked about fairness in Canada, and I do believe we are a fair nation. I do believe we're far more fortunate to live here than in many other parts of the world. However, we also live in a country where there remain many First Nations communities devoid of reliable, safe, and a constant supply of something as fundamental and human rights-oriented as clean drinking water, a requirement for health and life. I find that deeply disturbing, and so I can share with you, do so many of my listeners who send emails, and I saw emails yesterday from listeners who pointed this out, who wanted to write something about the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation, share something with me. And again, the issue of safe drinking water at First Nations communities was brought up. There's the bad in that it continues to exist, and the better as far as people just not willing to accept this any longer. Your thoughts, Chief?
The essentials to be a dreamer in this country include a good home fire, which include water. Nations were placed 100 plus years ago, many today, reserves we call them, by government forced to where they are. And today, there's a fiduciary obligation because of our treaty relationship and relationship with Canada and the Crown. And so we do need to do better. It is getting better, but I'm not trying to give just credit, but I'm just saying we need to do better. When we have healthy homes, when Indigenous can live where they want to live and not have to move just because they don't have that healthy home or that to be a dreamer, it really doesn't solve the healing journey we're on. And then just to more of the broader answer to your question, just beyond water. My wife and I raise a 5-year-old, 6-year-old now, little human being. And she told me, Roy, she wants to be a pilot. And my wife and I are going to do our best, Roy, to make her be a pilot. But here's the reality, Roy. We raise an Indigenous female, my wife and I. The toughest person to be in this country in 2022 is an Indigenous female. My wife and I have to try twice as hard to reap half the benefits that others who are raising a 6-year-old female who's non-Indigenous in this country. My wife and I, Roy, are going to put that effort in. But I hope one day that when my kids have a little girl, my granddaughter, they don't have to try twice as hard to reap half the benefits. That's why it is so important that we do truth and reconciliation calls to action one day at a time, because our kids rely on us to do something.
Yeah, that is just so disturbing to hear that. I mean, it's disturbing that your daughter has to face that. It's deeply encouraging that you and your wife will do it, but your daughter should not have to face that. So let me ask you this. You have worked with Prime Minister Trudeau, former Conservative Party leader Erin O'Toole, Premier Scott Moe, and I'm sure you'll be working with Pierre Poilievre going forward. So what role, Chief Delorme, does the in-place political structure, federal and provincial, have in nurturing objectively the objectives of truth and reconciliation?
That is a fundamental question. And, you know, the first is, We elect our officials. Municipal play a huge role as well. I just want to throw that in there. A lot of Indigenous people that don't live on the First Nation rely on city and RMs, and so that is just as important. But I'm going to give you an example of child welfare reform. I know our time is limited, and I could really explain things in a very long-winded manner. Cowes' First Nation has taken child welfare reform in this country by charge. We're leading the way, and I say that in a very humble way. We told Prime Minister Trudeau and the cabinet, we told Premier Moe and the cabinet, we control our children in care. We said cows is does. We never relinquished our right. It's our right. And we created our own law called the Mio P. Matisuan Act and Create Means Striving for a Better Life. And Justin and Scott came to Cowes's. We signed this coordination agreement where they invest in our law, and they got out of the way. In the first 16 months, Roy, we have no children in care on our reserve anymore. We knew what the families needed. We still have children in care off the reserve because we have jurisdiction off the reserve too. We're helping mothers go back to school. So kids are waking up watching their parents do homework in the morning. We're helping grandparents with respite who are raising their grandkids. Like, we are making fundamental growth right now with one area where governments, the toughest part I find governments have today is think of it like a vehicle. They have their hands on the steering wheel of the affairs of Indigenous people. Indigenous people are in the back seat yelling, saying, like, we're here. Let us put the hand on the steering wheel. That's the biggest challenge any government's going to have moving forward is how do they take their hand off the steering wheel and empower, and where they sit in the car, the Indigenous people will tell them. That is the true nature of a relationship, is Indigenous people do have the will, have the strength, have the education to control our destiny in many means.
The United States will never, never, never recognize Russia's claims on Ukraine's sovereign territory. This so-called referendum was a sham, an absolute sham. The results were manufactured in Moscow. The true will of the Ukrainian people is evident every day as they sacrifice their lives to save their people and maintain the independence of their country.
President Joe Biden, as increasingly the United States and Russia appear to be squaring off, the developing story coming out of Ukraine, Russia, as you know, annexing Ukraine provinces, at least that's what Putin said. Meanwhile, a major Russian army unit was surrounded and cut off by the Ukrainian military, and they have now withdrawn from an area that Putin says is part of Russia. They were ready to be, I suppose, annihilated, and like the Russian army has been taking it on the chin for some time now from the Ukrainians, so they've withdrawn. And the question becomes, and it's an uncomfortable question, but it's one that is raised across the world, and that is, would Putin engage battlefield nuclear weapons to defend what he says is the annexed Ukraine territory, the illegally annexed Ukraine territory? He says, Putin, he'd be willing to enter negotiations with Ukraine, but President Zelensky says, we'll do that as long as it's a new president of Russia. There's a lot on the plate here, a lot on the table. Alexander Sherba is with us, former Ukrainian ambassador to Austria, also ambassador at large following the 2014 Russian invasion. He's the author of Ukraine versus Darkness, Undiplomatic Thoughts. So Alexander, how are you?
I'm very good. How are you, Roy?
I'm well. Really an important day, an important week, significant week in this 8 months of nonstop fighting and madness from Putin. So now he says he made the annexation announcement saying that four regions of Ukraine are now part of Russia after his so-called referenda. And he engaged in more talk about using nuclear weapons and urging Ukraine to engage in negotiations with him. Now we found out that earlier today, the Russian military unit, which was encircled by Ukrainian military, in, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing this correctly, Lyman or Lyman, a city in one of the regions, Lyman, one of the regions Putin claims is part of Russia. So the Russians have withdrawn. Would you clarify for us, please, what's the situation on the ground today?
Well, the situation on the front line is beneficial for Ukrainian troops. We are moving further east. We are liberating small villages and locations in the south, in Kherson Oblast. There is Putin is sending more troops to the Ukrainian-Belarusian border. So we are conducting military exercises in the north to be sure that we are ready to welcome, quote-unquote, those. So that's the situation. It was a very, very dark and depressing day yesterday just to see this maniac conduct within 3 days so-called referenda, see how violently it was. We used to say raperandum. It was a rape just within 3 days, going from flat to flat, apartment to apartment, and under gun, forcing people to vote. There was this report about the guy who was for 3 weeks in their captivity, being tortured, and he was released only under one condition: he goes to referendum and votes the right way. So it was a dark day, and dark day to see Russia like that, like a full-fledged fascist state. But today is a new day, and we are winning this war, and Putin can do nothing about it.
It's a very important point to make, isn't it, that the Russians are not in control, not in full control of the four regions they now claim are part of Russia.
Absolutely. It's just, it's not only sham, it's insane what they're doing there. It's just, even Putin 2 weeks ago was absolutely reluctant to do that. And then all of a sudden clicks in his head, and all of a sudden within 3 days, these weaselings from these territories, these traitors address him, and he accepts, he proclaims them independent, four independent nations, Kherson independent nation, Luhansk independent nation, so on and so forth, and accepts them within Russian state. And if you saw the ceremony, you saw the faces of the people listening to Putin. It was nothing like the euphoria of the Crimean Steel. They understand how serious it is right now, and they are losing the war, and they are losing their the country that they thought, the Russian political elite thought, was theirs. But this country can fall apart. It's a real possibility right now if Ukraine moves further on, and I'm very sure about that.
Yeah, it's interesting because later on in the hour, we're going to be talking to the director of an organization known as the ARC. They are in Georgia, which is a former Soviet republic, of course, on the border with Russia. And hundreds of thousands of Russians have fled the country since the war began. And the ARC is funded by Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who once was Russia's wealthiest man, owned the second largest oil company in Russia, but was imprisoned by Putin and remains one of his most determined adversaries. We're going to find out just what it's like at the borders as Russians try to escape Putin and his version of Russia. One of the greatest concerns, Alexander, of course, is the potential for nuclear weapons. Putin brings this up each time he speaks internationally. And the question about the potential unleashing of battlefield nuclear weapons hangs in the air. How concerned are you about that?
Well, we understand that it's a possibility both for big cities and for our troops on the front line. But militarily, both would make so little sense. Humanely, it would make so little sense because it's not 1945. Ukraine is not Japan. Ukraine is not losing the war. Everything, all it would do to Ukraine, it would make us even angrier. I spoke today with a guy who fought on the front line. Now he's back. And I asked him what would happen if they do use a nuclear weapon. And he says it will make us only angrier. Right now, there is a possibility for Ukrainian troops to reach the border with Russia and stop. But if they do use these nuclear weapons, there will be no stopping. We'll go to Russian territory, and it will be brutal. So I hope Putin not so detached from reality. He must understand that it's not 1945. We are not Japan.
Yeah, if you think back to February the 24th, when the invasion began, and very knowledgeable people militarily, globally, were saying, well, Ukraine could fall in 72 hours. Kyiv could be really in Russian hands within 72 hours. And here we are on the 1st of October, and you're quite logically talking about the potential for the Ukrainian army to be crossing the border into Russia if Putin unleashes battlefield nuclear weapons. That's how decisively the Ukrainian army is handling what was supposed to be one of the great militaries in the world, the Russian military. Alexander, we were talking about the mindset of Putin. We're trying to figure out what is going on in his head. So he's a child of the Soviet Union, was a KGB member, and clearly he longs for the return of the USSR. You've told us on the air that you grew up in the Soviet Union when Ukraine was forced to remain a member. Do you have an understanding of the mindset of Vladimir Putin? What's causing him, to the best of your understanding, to behave the way he is?
Well, all these years, the world was giving him this delusion that he is this amazing, wonderful, wise politician. Everybody wanted a piece of him. Everybody wanted to talk to him some of his time. People forgave him the second Chechnya war, amazingly cruel. People forgave countries, politicians forgave him what he did in Georgia, what he did in Crimea. And he was heading to a goal of his that I think was his goal for quite a while, namely recreating the Soviet Union 2.0. And the key factor to that, element to that, is, of course, Ukraine. He was heading to this war for years, and he was absolutely sure that Ukraine would be sitting duck, so to say. Now, when all his plans went down the drain and the whole world has seen that the king is naked and the army is incapable or in disarray, and what Russia really is, he's just, I think, more or less going with the flow. It's just not, maybe in this particular situation, he was going with the flow with the will of these so-called presidents of these so-called, you know, independent republics, because they saw that Russia would abandon them like they abandoned people in Kherson Oblast, traitors in Kherson Oblast. So if he hadn't done something drastic to encourage the traitors on the occupied territories, everything would fall apart within days. So he had to do something drastic, and he did.
Yeah, he did. Now, he has, in that speech on Wednesday, he said he wants Ukraine to come to the negotiating table and to think reasonably. That's what he said. I'm paraphrasing, but the reply by President Zelensky was, yeah, we'll negotiate with Russia, but not with this guy. With a new president, negotiations only possible with a new Russian president. Ukraine is also asking for an accelerated NATO membership. What are the realistic chances, do you believe, for either happening? Number one, Putin to be disposed of from within within Russia? And what's your sense about an accelerated acceptance of Ukraine by NATO?
Well, to your first question, there is this, you know, the idea, maybe it's wishful thinking on our part, but Putin's 70th birthday is coming. And people think that the reason why he accelerated all these things, because he wants to wrap things up here and then to make the announcement akin to that Yeltsin did in the end of 1999. I've done what I could, and I'm tired, and I picked a successor, and like going away, you know. Quite frankly, of course, it's most likely it's just wishful thinking on our part. But President Zelensky saying this publicly, that we will speak only with any other guy as a president, but not this insane person. Maybe Zelensky has some idea what's happening next. Other than that, if Putin, and it's most likely Putin, remains in power, Well, what's the point of negotiating with him who invades you, who takes away the territory, occupies, and then says, let's talk about how we legalize what I took away. It's just nonsense. We are not going to do that. Only countries that lose wars do that, and we are not losing this war. And about the NATO membership, well, quite frankly, it was a very, very good move on Ukraine's part. It had people like me for a couple of hours very encouraged. We hoped that it would be somehow endorsed by the NATO Secretary General. And then he came and spoke in his not very exciting and inspiring manner and said the usual thing. Doors of NATO are open to all European democracies, but right now we should be focusing on something else. And it was, of course, a turn on for many people here. But I think the direction of Ukraine is very clear. We are not making any compromises with this aggressor, with this occupier, and therefore we are moving in direction of our real partners and our real partners in the NATO. Everything is logical. Putin on his way out, and Ukraine is on her way up, and NATO should support it. And I'm immensely thankful for Canada that supported us right away. About the dates when it will happen, de facto, we are already a NATO country. When it will be de jure, I don't know, but it will definitely happen.
It's true, de facto. It seems like a de facto reality. The weapon systems that are being delivered by NATO nations to Ukraine are really of the most sophisticated variety now. And President Biden said earlier in the week that as far as the United States is concerned, use those weapon systems any way you want. They have placed restrictions initially, but they're saying no longer. So we just have a few seconds left, Alexander. How significant and how important and how effective is it still to impose more sanctions on Russia?
Well, absolutely instrumental. First of all, you should impose sanctions on Gazprom Bank and a couple of other banks, shut them down from SWIFT. That would be hurting. Plus, of course, you know, energy sanctions. Europe should remain on the course of, you know, imposing full and complete embargo on gas and oil. That would be hurting, and that's very important.
There's an organization known as the ARC. It's a support group for Russians who are fleeing their country. And between the 24th of February, when the Russian invasion began, and today, hundreds of thousands of Russians have escaped the country because of their anti-war position, and they condemn the military aggression against Ukraine. They also don't see much of a future in the country under Putin. Now, the co-founder and the key funder of the ARC is Mikhail Khodorkovsky, also known as MBK. He was once Russia's richest man, was imprisoned by Putin, and remains one of Putin's most determined adversaries. Anastasia Burakova is the director of the ARC. She joins us from Georgia, the former Soviet Republic, which borders on Russia. Anastasia, thank you very much for taking the time to join us. Can you share with us, please, how the ARC came to be, and how is Mr. Khodorkovsky associated, engaged with the organization?
Thank you for the invitation. The ARC project was launched right after the beginning of the war. I'm a lawyer and human rights defender, and many political activists and independent journalists have my telephone number. And when I received more than 100 questions and calls about relocation, I understood that we need to help systematically. And I asked to my colleagues to help me with legal consultations. We created a special program, a bot for it. And at the same time, I asked anti-war committee launched by Mikhail Khodorkovsky and others to support the project. And we used their website. Committee members shared information about the project, and Mikhail Khodorkovsky gave funds to rent flats for co-living flats. For the first time. So that's how the ARC project was launched.
So hundreds of thousands of Russians have gone to the border and gotten out of the country. We've seen the lineups on the border between Russia and Finland, the lineups of the border, I believe, between Russia and Kazakhstan, and the lineups of the border between Russia and Georgia. Hundreds of thousands of Russians have exited since the war began. Many of them, from what I understand, have very little in the way of a plan. They have no job, very little in the way of savings or security. Their bank cards are blocked. Finding an apartment outside of Russia is extremely difficult. And living day to day must be an extreme challenge. So why, and I gave my thoughts here, but you tell me yours, why are so many Russian people willing to assume such a risk and uncertainty?
So honestly, a lot of people face it with pressure because of their anti-war position immediately when the war began. So I'm speaking not only about dissidents in usual meaning, but many ordinary people who were not involved in opposition organizations, political party structures, just, for example, signed anti-war petitions and lost their jobs, sent money for humanitarian aid for Ukrainian refugees, and police came to their houses. So more than 16,000 people were detained because of participation in peaceful demonstration during the first week after the beginning of the war. So they have a risk to go to prison under the new criminal articles connected with critique of Russian military forces. And at the same time, many Russians don't want to be associated with bloody Putin's aggression against Ukraine. So issues that they face abroad so are much less problematic compared with the war and suffering of Ukrainians.
Yeah, we saw some stories the other day that Russian soldiers had actually taken away children who were protesting with their parents against the war, taking away children. When it comes to people who are leaving, or let me ask you this. Inside Russia, you said it's illegal to challenge the war. What happens to journalists who openly are critical of Putin and the war? What happens to Russian journalists?
So as I told you before, Russian parliament adopts new criminal articles against freedom of speech. And you can go to prison, for example, for 10 years just if you call the war by its name. So Russian officials call it special military operation. More than 100 independent media were blocked after the beginning of the war, and all opposition political movements were closed. So I can compare it with Hitler's censorship in 1933.
Wow. So if you call it anything other, if I'm a journalist in Russia, and I were to report on this, and I were to call it anything other than the special military operation, I could be arrested and sent to prison for 10 years.
Yeah, so it's, there are two criminal articles about critique of Russian military forces, and maximum punishment is 10 years in prison, just if you call the war by its name.
How difficult is it now? Maybe not so difficult a few months ago. I don't know. I'll ask you. How difficult is it for Russians to leave the country today? Now, we've seen video and photographs of long lineups at land border crossings. I mentioned earlier Finland, Kazakhstan, and Georgia. How difficult is it for Russians to get out?
After the mobilization was announced by Putin, so hundreds of thousands of Russians tried to leave the country. And I can say that it's the second huge wave of immigration after the war was started. Sometimes people spend, for example, 3-5 days in the lines to cross the land border with Kazakhstan, Georgia, Mongolia, Finland. Prices for flights increase in 20 times. Sometimes, for example, usual price for flight to Yerevan, Armenia is $200. But if you want to buy the ticket now to close the date, it can be $4,000 or more.
And they don't have that money. I mean, most people in Russia don't have a lot of money.
Yeah, for sure. A lot of people can't buy, for example, tickets to flights. That.
Yeah, you still there? Do we still have Anastasia? Okay, so we had a bit of a disconnect there. So, we have talked a lot on this program about inflation, of course. We all talk about inflation because it hits each and every one of us. Interest rates, similarly. And you know, my definition of inflation has been, it's on the day that you go to the gas station and the grocery store in the same morning and you cannot afford to fill up at either. Well, that's becoming an increasing reality. Even though the price of gas has gone down, the price of food continues to skyrocket. And as our guest told us last weekend, the inflation rate on food has outpaced the general inflation rate for 13 consecutive months. Now, does this mean corporate greedflation at the grocery stores of Canada? Is it time for grocery chains to freeze prices of certain food staples, as is being done by some European chains? 78% of Canadians told Angus Reid Polling they believe grocery stores are engaged in greedflation. We're joined by Professor Sylvain Charlebois, Director of the Agri-Foods Analytics Laboratory and Professor at Dalhousie University. He testified Wednesday at the House of Commons Agriculture Committee. Sylvain, thank you very much for joining us. Now, we talked last weekend some about the issue of greedflation. So what's the perspective that you bring? And what did you tell parliamentarians on the issue of food inflation?
Actually, Roy, I testified before the Standing Committee of Finance, not Agriculture, which is it's a little detail, but it's actually quite significant because they actually look at inflation from an economics perspective, obviously, and how food prices are impacting everyone. So it's not just ag; it's the economy, and they were. They were interested in knowing more about, obviously, greedflation, if why are prices going up, and if we were able to explain some of it. And my answer to them was, yes, we can explain some of the inflation, but not all. We do believe that there is some unreasonable hikes at the grocery store that we can't explain with some verticals, really, namely meat prices, I would say. So meat, bakery, even dairy, there's some question marks there. But overall, MPs were very much interested in knowing more about this and whether or not Canadians are right. Canadians have every right to be skeptical and critical because, you know, there's a track record of colluding in the industry with bread a few years ago, but we actually haven't seen we haven't found any evidence that grocers, particularly grocers, are abusing.
Yeah, and grocers are saying, the watch chain is saying, it's just not happening. People who are accusing them of doing that are not aware of the realities and the dynamics of the situation in the industry. But when you get, and you know this, when you get 78% of Canadians agreeing on anything, even though today is Saturday, that is really quite something, because you cannot get Canadians to agree on anything in those numbers generally. When you have the dynamic right across the country, Sylvain, That speaks to a common denominator issue here.
And I'm concerned for the grocery business, to be honest, their image. I mean, there's not a day that goes by when grocers are completely destroyed on social media. Everyone is criticizing them. And I've suggested to both the Retail Council of Canada and the Canadian Independent Grocers of Canada, the Federation representing independent grocers, I've been telling them, you got to do something. What is your strategy here? And the one thing that we have proposed very openly was to voluntarily freeze some prices for a period of time to just give a chance for consumers to breathe a little bit. And in fact, Canada is the only G7 country right now without one grocer doing that. We're seeing it all over the world. It's been happening for at least 6 months now, giving a break to consumers. And we're not talking about regulating prices. It's just it's more of a PR strategy, I guess, to show empathy towards the public. But right now, what I'm seeing is an industry resisting to any sort of proposal that would show any empathy at all, which is a bit disappointing, to be honest, Roy. I think grocers need a strategy, because right now, most people think they're evil. They're not. But at the same time, they are interacting with struggling consumers as well.
And, you know, the image that you established today is the image that you carry around with you tomorrow. So during difficult times, if you step up and you do what some of the other grocery chains are doing, as you say, in other G7 countries, and you say, look, we have these staples, and on these two or three staple foods, we're going to lower or at least freeze the price for a couple of months to give you an opportunity to just get caught up. I think that sort of move, and you just said that, I'm just rephrasing it, that sort of move can go a long way to establishing a positive relationship between the grocery store and the consumer.
My understanding, while interacting with both the Retail Council and the Canadian Federation of Independent Grocers, is that if they actually freeze prices, they'll admit guilt, which I don't agree with. I don't think that if you show empathy, you're immediately admitting guilt that you were colluding, that you were increasing prices.
I don't think so either. No.
Exactly. And so that, I think that's why they're hesitating and they're pushing back on the idea.
So what's your sense? Just remind us, please, what happened with the bread 4 years ago?
So the bread price fixing scheme was announced, I guess, back on December 20th. 2017, that was 5 years ago, when Galen Weston stood in front of cameras, apologizing to the public, admitting that both Loblaws and Weston Bakeries, which was owned by Loblaws as well at the time, they admitted of colluding for 14 years, basically with other grocers. Now, there was an investigation going on led by the Competition Bureau. They've actually looked into Metro and Sobeys and Walmart and Costco, but other retailers. Giant Tiger was also included because Loblaws at the time, 5 years ago, disclosed that everyone was in on this. But since then, Roy, everyone has denied it. So there's been an investigation and nobody has went to jail. Nobody's been fined yet. And so if consumers out there are skeptical and they think there's greedflation going on, they have every right to believe that, because we haven't really seen any penalties. All we did get a $25 gift card. I hope you did get your gift card, Rory. Did you?
No.
You didn't? Oh, my goodness. You should. I think I'm not sure you can still apply, but basically they gave $25
right now,
to all Canadians.
I'm applying right now.
You are? There you go.
When I'm on the air with you.
There you go. Let's go shop at Loblaws together and see what happens.
No, but it's true. Look, you can, what you do today is going to be with you tomorrow. And people remember when somebody steps forward and does something positive for them during difficult times. It's the way we are. It's human nature. We want to say thank you. We also want to remember when it's not done. And I think the grocers have an opportunity here, as you clearly say. And when 78% of the people in this country believe that greedflation is taking place, that's not something you can just push into the corner and try to ignore it. Not smart to do that. Not smart.
The one advice I would give to grocers right now, since we're a week away from Thanksgiving, I would voluntarily freeze prices on turkey, cranberry sauce, potatoes, and pumpkin pie.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you want to hear more, subscribe to The Roy Green Show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorites. And if you like what you hear, leave us a review and tell a friend. I'm Roy Green. Have a great weekend.
I'm not just a pawn in this game.
Three nights a week on Global.
They're putting targets on their back. Massive.
Drama.
I guess you could say I'm in a showman.
They're just so in love and so annoying. Enough.
Betrayal.
The guy just put up his best friend now.
And plot twists.
What is happening right now?
You'll never see coming.
If you're coming for me,
this is perfect.
I'm coming for you then.
It'll be a battle.
Like, it'll be war.
Big Brother Canada. All new Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Sundays on Global. Stream on Stack TV.